This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 250 years ago, on a quiet December night, Boston made history.
They boarded the ships, demanded that the captain open the hatchways. They grabbed hoisting tackle and ropes. Some of the men jumped into the hold and passed the tea chests to the tackle. They hoisted the chests on deck, smashed them open with axes, raised them to the railings, and dumped the contents overboard.
Quiet night no more, the Boston Tea Party. It was a protest over taxes and representation that would spark a revolution and later a declaration.
What has largely been a political and constitutional crisis is about to become a military crisis. And the triggering event is the Boston Tea Party.
Those events were nearly three centuries ago now, but their impact and influence still invoked today.
1776!
You're afraid of Antifa? Well, guess what? America showed up!
We heard there Professor Benjamin Karp of SUNY, local author and historian J.L. Bell, and rioters on January 6th, 2021. The sound was courtesy of Tufts University, Revolutionary Spaces, and The New Yorker. Massachusetts launches official events marking the 250th today, so let's talk about this watershed moment of Boston and American history, beginning with going through what happened on December 16, 1773, and the days leading up to it. Robert Allison is a professor of history at Suffolk University and author of the book The Boston Tea Party. Jonathan Lane is the executive director of Revolution 250, a group of organizations across the state to commemorate the American Revolution and the events that led to it, also a direct descendant of the Sons of Liberty. And Evan O'Brien is the creative manager for the Boston Tea Party ships and museum and leading the efforts to mark the Boston Tea Party tomorrow. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Jonathan, great to have you.
Thank you for having us.
And Evan, welcome to you, too.
Thank you so much.
And Evan, I got to say, I'm so mad at myself. My daughter worked at the Tea Party Museum over the summer. I have tea at home. I meant to bring it today, and I forgot it. So let's start there. Why? I mean, this is such a, right, why is Boston Tea Party such a part of our lore? Was it really one of the triggering moments?
Absolutely it was. We look at the Boston Tea Party as one of the most important events leading up to the American Revolution. It was, as you said, a watershed moment, a catalyst that propelled America down the road to revolution. And it was the culmination of years' worth of frustration about taxation without representation and widespread unrest. And it was only 16 months between when the tea hit the water and it was destroyed in Boston Harbor and the first shots of the American Revolution would be fired. Would the American Revolution have happened without the Boston Tea Party? Probably. But did the Boston Tea Party accelerate that? Absolutely.
So Bob Allison of Suffolk University, Evan's just sort of set up from the Boston Tea Party to the 16 months. I want to now go back to the time leading up to the Boston Tea Party. The colonies are under British rule. Great Britain is in debt after the Seven Years' War. A lot of this is about money, debt, taxes,
it is,
right?
It is. And the big issue was the East India Company was in debt. It had taken
this
over
is
much
a British
of
India, company.
A British company, one of the largest corporations in the world. And it had been taking over India since about 1690. And now, just at this finishing this, it's heavily in debt, goes to Parliament for a bailout. Lord North offers them £15 million, also says he'll get to appoint their board of directors. Also, they can ship tea directly to North America. So this, the Bostonians think, is putting them not only under the reign of Parliament, but under the reign of this corporation, the East India Company. And that's why they and people in Philadelphia, Charleston, South Carolina, are going to resist the landing of the tea.
So, Jonathan, you may be able to answer this question. You may not. My understanding from a book I read earlier this year, there's a new history of Boston that author Daniel Dane mm-hmm. wrote. We were also, we being Boston, with all the tax stuff going on with Great Britain, we were also smuggling in other tea from other places. And so there was a lot of, like, dirty deeds going on in the backdrop here.
That's correct. And to put it all into perspective, in 1770, it's calculated that Americans imported 1 million pounds of tea. Now, they were supposed to pay a 3 pence per pound tax on that tea, but in reality, they only paid duty on 92,000 pounds that year, meaning almost
I'm sorry.
Yeah, 10%. And so you get to the understanding of the scale of the problem from the British perspective.
Okay, so there was some smuggling going on. There was some sneaking going on. There was a lot of tea drinking going on. And then what is this moment, Evan, that, I don't know, you might say tips, you might say catapults, you might say triggers, pick your word, a throwdown of a different nature, Evan.
Well, I think the tea crisis really kicks into high gear. You know, Bob set up the monopoly of the East India Company perfectly. With the arrival of the first vessel on November 28th.
And there are three of them.
There are three, yeah. The Dartmouth was the first to arrive on November 28th, 1773. That set in motion a ticking clock, a deadline of 20 days due to the Navigation Acts all the way back to the 1650s, saying that when a vessel arrived in port, that vessel had 20 days to check in with the custom house, offload the cargo, and pay the duties associated with that cargo. So that sets in motion for the Sons of Liberty and the townsfolk of Boston the beginning of the tea crisis, which then culminates about 19 days later with the destruction of the tea. And they waited until the expiration of that 20-day deadline to really act. During that time, meetings of the body of the people, town meetings, spring up with many, many meetings discussing and debating what to do about this pernicious tea. So when the Dartmouth arrived, to answer your question, that's really when everything really kicks into high gear. After that, the Eleanor, the second vessel also carrying tea, and Beaver would arrive. And by the time the Beaver ties up to Griffin's Wharf the day before the Boston Tea Party, the plan is pretty much already in place, and they're just waiting to get word from the royal governor as to whether or not the tea can be sent back to England or ultimately would meet its fate in Boston's
Harbor. Poor Beaver doesn't even stand a chance.
Exactly.
All right, so we're with Evan O'Brien, creative manager of the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum, Jonathan Lane, executive director of Revolution 250, and Bob Allison, who is a professor of history at Suffolk University. And in this first part of today's Radio Boston, we are doing what is the Boston Tea Party and what actually happened as we're marking what tomorrow will officially be the 250th anniversary. So I'll come back to you, Bob Allison, as I try to pick which of the 7,000 questions I now have in my head I want to ask next. This idea that there was 20 days, right? I've always wondered this. Why? Why does it matter how fast it gets loaded and that has to leave? Is it because there's literally no parking room for other ships? Or why is this ticking clock an important thing?
Well, it does go back to the whole smuggling question.
Okay.
If it's here for less than 20 days, yeah, maybe they weren't selling stuff. If it's here for more than 20 days, probably they have been unloading stuff. So if it doesn't sail within 20 days, the cargo has to be unloaded and taxed. That was just to make sure there is less smuggling than we know is going to go on.
Okay. So Jonathan Lane, and I am wearing this really cool scarf that you brought in, the Revolution 250. As part of this year, you actually did the formal thing to trace your lineage, and you know that and this came through the Boston Tea Party Museum, you're a chance to do this. You now know you are a descendant of the Sons of Liberty.
Yes, as a matter of fact. And, you know, to be fair, when you find that your ancestors have been living in the same area for 400 years, chances are they're going to get into trouble somewhere along the way. And certainly with William Breck, who is a known member of the Sons of Liberty. He belonged to the North End Caucus. He was a tinsmith and hardware merchant. He was recommended by John Hancock to other merchants in Britain as a safe credit risk. He had Paul Revere engrave his business card, the trade card that he utilized. And he was present at the dinners that the Sons of Liberty held annually in August in commemoration of their celebrations surrounding the repeal of the Stamp Act.
Yeah, if it makes you feel any better, in my genealogy, we have several people who were in Leavenworth, so it's all good, right? We're fine. But I do wonder, Jonathan, this idea of, and we're gonna dive deep into this later, so this is a touch for now, because later in the show I'm going deep, patriot versus criminal. I mean, we're talking about smuggling. We're talking about damaging what, the National Park Service says was just a little bit short of $2 million in today's dollars of tea. And as I understand it, lots of threatening physical harm of people who were responsible for those ships and living in town. They actually left to Castle Island because they were concerned for their bodily safety.
Sure. And this is a narrative that actually goes back to 1765 when the Stamp Act crisis occurred here in Boston. And there are entire buildings that are destroyed because the people feel they're harboring the dreaded stamped paper that they were going to have to pay the duty on. And, you know, the Sons of Liberty learned from that experience that the people of Massachusetts, not terribly keen on property destruction. and that's the elegance of what they did at the Boston Tea Party, in that it was only the tea that got destroyed, even to the point where a broken lock was replaced by the Sons of Liberty so they could say the only thing that got destroyed was this tea that was being foisted upon us by British authority.
Evan, why was that smart?
Well, I think it's smart for just the overall optics of the event. You know, the Sons of Liberty had gotten a bad rap from what Jonathan was just talking about, literal buildings being torn down. Here, I love the word, there is an elegance in that. John Adams would call the actions of the Sons of Liberty the most magnificent movement of all. He would even say there's a majesty in what they were doing. Now, of course, he was had a very patriotic view of this event.
I can't raise one eyebrow,
right.
But if I could, I would.
Oh, I understand. But I think they were very smart in making sure that the other cargoes on board the vessels were not damaged. Some of the other cargoes had already been removed, which is also key to this whole thing. But the Brig Beaver, because it arrived so late, her hold was filled with cargo, including furniture and fine wares and things like that. Not a single shred of that cargo was damaged.
So we know, I believe, Bob Ellison, I believe it was the Dartmouth that contained the first printed copies of Phyllis Wheatley's
right.
first published book of poems.
Yes.
We actually did hear on the show the play that is part of this celebration from Revolutionary Spaces, the play about that. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things were on those ships?
One was carrying streetlights. John Rowe, who was a Boston merchant, Rowe's Wharf was his wharf, bought streetlights to light the streets of Boston because after dark, of course, it's dark. And so that was a big thing. And then, as Evan said, furniture, other things that people were shipping. These ships basically were commandeered. One of the great myths we have is these were the king's ships or British ships. They were all owned by people in Massachusetts. And they were built in Massachusetts. And the captains are from Massachusetts. The crews are from Massachusetts. They're carrying this cargo, essentially hauling it at the expense of for the East India Company. They ship owners don't get paid until the tea is unloaded and sold. So they're really on the hook for this.
And again, we'll come back to you. This was nearly $2 million worth of tea in today's dollars.
Right,
sorry,
right.
Go ahead.
So they have a lot of other things. So Phyllis Wheatley was originally from Senegal, and she had gone to England, and there printed
She had been enslaved here.
She was enslaved here by the Wheatley family. She had arrived on a ship called the Phyllis, and she was about 7 years old at the time, very quickly learned how to read and write, and then learned Latin and Greek, and when she was a teenager, began writing poetry. Her first published poem was about George Whitefield, the great evangelist, and she had this collection of poems, wanted to publish it here, but the publishers wanted her, or the Wheatley family, to pay for it. She goes to England, and there the Countess of Huntingdon, who is a great philanthropist, pays for the publication of the book. That's why it's printed in London, and it arrives on the Dartmouth, and on December 2nd, it was actually unloaded and then sold. So we have the first published African-American poet. Her books are arriving on one of these ships, and that really is a signal moment with the publication of Phyllis's book. There's a lot we can say about Phyllis Wheatley, whose poetry also arrived on the Dartmouth.
So we're speaking again with Bob Ellison of Suffolk University, Jonathan Lane of Revolution 250, and Evan O'Brien of the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum, learning the history piece of this 250th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. So one of the things that I learned, Jonathan Lane, as I was sort of studying for today, and you as a group have already made reference to this, there were other ships going other places, there was a less disruptive outcome in places like down the Carolinas and in Pennsylvania. And I wonder, I find myself wondering, Jonathan, so those ships eventually were sent back, right? They were allowed to leave. There wasn't as much destruction, et cetera. The other colonies, were they like, oh, God, look what Boston did, right? Or was it, yeah, Boston, go, go, go?
Well, I actually think that is one of the keys to the way this whole event unfolded. The people of Philadelphia had actually passed a series of resolves in advance of the tea decision here in Boston, essentially saying you cannot let the tea land. And there had been a non-importation agreement earlier that the people of Boston got behind and adopted for a while, but it kind of faded out. And the people of Philadelphia and New York thought Bostonians might be a little squishy.
We were wishy-washy
allies. Yeah, a little wishy-washy. And so they really looked to the people of Boston to stand firm and to, you know, do whatever it took to make sure the tea didn't get landed. And I also want to add that the tea crisis is also hotly debated in towns around Massachusetts. So it's not just the people of Boston who are standing up. And these towns are voting and sending resolves to the people of Boston, to the Committee of Correspondents. And I really think that that gave them the courage and the backing to do what they ultimately did.
So, Evan, I feel like we actually need to know a little bit about the tea.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the actual tea.
Sure. So there were five different types of teas involved in the Boston Tea Party, three black teas and two green teas. They were all coming from China in the Wuyi Mountains of the Fujian province. Depending on, you know, which type of tea you're drinking, it's usually from the same plant. It just depends on what time of the year those leaves are picked. So the green teas were picked very early on in the spring, at the very end of winter, just as the plant was kind of coming back to life. The black teas were picked a little bit later on in the year. The leaves had more of a chance to oxidize. They would have been packed into wooden tea chests made largely of poplar or spruce in China and then shipped to London warehouses, where sometimes they sat for a very long time. And this also plays into the Tea Party of 1773, where that tea that the East India Company was sending to us was long past its expiration date. Several years, as a matter of fact. So not only were we being taxed for the tea, they were sending us tea of not so great a quality,
too. So it doesn't age like a fine wine.
Not exactly, no. And the East India Company did not have a refined opinion of the people of Boston's palate when it comes to tea. So the tea would have been then shipped to London, to the American colonies from London, either in the same chests it had been shipped to from China or repackaged into other tea chests, loaded on board these vessels, and then sent to the American colonies. The chests themselves that arrived in Boston would have been wooden chests with a simple lead foil inside to keep it watertight. They were wrapped in a white canvas and stitched close, again, to keep it protected for its transatlantic voyage with the merchant mark of the East India Company stamped on the outside.
So, Bob Allison, as we begin to sort of wind down this part, how important is where the tea came from, sort of in our understanding? I have been struck as I'm learning just how much this was just about the economy piece, not just reductive, but very much about the economy piece. So how important is it where the tea came from?
Well, it's really a global story because the East India Company, if we were in London thinking about the empire, the colonies, we wouldn't have Massachusetts on our mind or Pennsylvania or Virginia. We'd be thinking first of Barbados and Jamaica, the sugar-producing islands, or India. And India not only has lots of things it's producing, cloth and great riches, but also has access to China. And getting to the East had been the whole root of colonization, the whole colonial enterprise. So this, the British Empire is one. They now have access to the markets of China and to India. So it really is this global story about an empire, and the Bostonians, by destroying the tea, disrupt that.
All right. So in our last 2 minutes, I want to make sure our listeners know what's going to happen over the next 24, 48 hours. Jonathan's pointing to Evan. So Evan, run it down briefly for us.
Absolutely. So tomorrow is the culmination of an entire commemorative year of special programming, special exhibits and performances with the grand scale reenactment of the Boston Tea Party. It takes place in various acts all throughout the city. Beginning at 4 o'clock at Faneuil Hall, there is a reenactment and retrospective on revolution.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes, at 4 p.m. at Faneuil Hall. And in there, we'll be talking about the beginning of the tea crisis in 1773, but also reflecting on both a bicentennial and centennial commemorations that took place inside that building every, 100 years or so. After that, there will be a rolling rally from Downtown Crossing. But before that, our colleagues at Revolutionary Spaces at 6:15 will be producing a reenactment of the meetings of the body of the people inside Old South Meeting House. That rolling rally will then process through the streets of Boston down to the waterfront, where at 8 o'clock we will begin to throw the tea into Boston Harbor at the same location where it occurred exactly 250 years ago. There'll be seating and standing room for many thousands of people, and this is a reenactment in grand scale, fully supported with light and sound so everyone can see and hear.
And the tea was contributed from people all over the world.
All over the world. Over 7,000 donations now have come in from all 50 states across the U.S. and many countries all around the world, as far away as Tunisia, Portugal, Spain, Australia, U.K., Ireland. And some of these have been small submissions in simple envelopes, others much larger. We've even received 250 pounds of tea from the same East India Company.
Interesting.
We got their permission this year to be involved.
Well, that's good. Jonathan, last word to you. I wonder, do you think there's some moment tomorrow where you're going to hear the echo of your ancestors?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the story, as our friend Evan likes to tell us, is about ordinary people who did an extraordinary thing. And I'm glad, Ed, that I will feel the footsteps of ancestors tomorrow.
And Bob, is it okay if at some point tomorrow somebody feels a little scared or uncomfortable with the thought of 100 people taking axes to a ship and dumping the property into the water?
Well, definitely. But also they should feel empowered because they're doing this so that they can continue governing themselves and won't be at the whim of a distant parliament and a distant empire and a distant corporation.
What an opportunity to connect our past with our present. Bob Allison is the professor of history at Suffolk University and author of the book The Boston Tea Party. Jonathan Lane is executive director of Revolution 250, which is a group of organizations working to mark this. And Evan O'Brien is creative manager of the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museums. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thank you very much.